So I've entitled this section "The Capitalist State Today in the Era of Neoliberalism." I mean, what I've seen is that with all major economic restructuring, I mean, force is necessary by capitalism to move the developing situations towards a new balance of class relationships more favourable to the capitalist class, and it's never death or pain-free for the working class. I mean, as capitalism became more unfettered in the 1980s and since, the capitalist state has relied more on its own forces, the police, to ensure the new economic relationships are accepted. And significantly, although statistics claim crime is going down, the prison population has doubled in size in the last 30 years. Now, I'll speak briefly about the prison population a little bit later when we get to, later on in this section. Actually, quite soon, actually. So today we've got austerity economics in Britain, but also dissent is actually ruthlessly quite dealt with. Now, what I've written here, actually, I wrote while the coalition government was in power, actually, it was to do with something else. But dissent is actually ruthlessly dealt with. I mean, police threatened to shoot protesting students. I mean, the 2011 social breakdown in the inner cities resulted in, obviously, political sentences for rioters. And also, I mentioned the concept of pre-crime is now used to prevent any dissent against the bourgeois consensus of, because I wrote it in this year, Royal Wedding, Diamond Jubilee and the Olympics. You know, people like Chris Knight, the anthropologist, was arrested, and a lot of other people were arrested who were planning to protest against, say, the Royal Wedding or the Royal Christening or whatever bourgeois crap it was. And people were actually arrested in advance by the Metropolitan Police for actually committing any offence. Just to move on. So the neoliberal capitalist free market is, they speak about the dead hand of the state, rolling back the frontiers of the state, ending state capitalism, you know, they attack the nanny state and things like that. But the irony is that contrary to all their hopes, the neoliberal hopes, you know, the free marketeer capitalists, there's not been any withering away of the state. I mean, it's just been a stripping back of the state to its core military and police functions. I mean, in Britain, for example, the police numbers have actually doubled in the last 30 years. And again, like I said a few minutes ago, crime is supposedly going down and the prison population is doubled in that same period of time. But also, the capitalist class, even though they hate the state, supposedly, the capitalist state, or whatever you want to call it, but at the time of the 2008 financial crisis, at the invitation of the capitalist class, the state rushed in to shore up the banking system. In the USA, for example, $700 billion emergency bailout. And I think in Britain it was in the realm of £500 billion was provided to the bank by the state. Yeah, so I spoke briefly, so I mentioned the prison population. Yeah, let me just give you some figures, because it's just bizarre. I mean, the prison population in this country has leapt between 1990 and 2000, when the numbers increased by about 50%, just a 50% increase just between 1990 and 2000. And again, it increased by 10,000 between 2000 and 2004, and then another 10,000 between 2004 and 2010. Let me just make that a bit clearer. So 1980, 42,000 people in prison. 1990, 45,000. 2000, in the year 2000, 65,000. 2004, 75,000. 2010, 85,000. And because I got these figures a few years ago, September 2011, 87,000. I think the maximum, I think it's a breaking point, isn't it? There's no places left. But they are talking about building more. Like I said earlier, in the 90s and the 2000s, we were told crime rates are dropping, but more people are going into prison. Are the working class actually committing more crimes? Well, I'd say no. No, the state has actually increased the number of laws, and police are targeting more people to send to prison. There's a criminalisation of poverty, the vulnerable, the non-productive members of capitalist society. But what it shows to the public, and the media actually carry this out, it shows that the state and the police are actually managing crime effectively. I mean, crime and crime control are part of the capitalist state control policy. So this world that we live in now in 2015, really, this sort of neoliberal world, and also this with increasing state repression, it really begins in the 1980s. The first thing I can think of really is the Warrington print dispute, which was 1983 to 84. I mean, paramilitary riot policing was actually used for the first time in an industrial dispute on the British mainland. And also the miners' strike, which I will come back to a little bit later in my section called Police Crimes Against the Working Class. And then we've got the Wapping and Printers dispute as well in the 86-87. Another thing I wanted to talk about, though, is you know, is the alternative society, you know, the New Age travellers, the Peace Convoy. People may remember them from the 1980s. I mean, they grew out of the counterculture of the late 60s, early 70s. I mean, and they were targeted, really, really targeted hard by the British state in the 1980s. You know, people forget about what actually happened. I'll just give you just a few examples. I mean, riot police, fresh from Orgreave in June 1984, where they'd been bashing miners overhead, then went to a place called Nostell Priory near Leeds, where the Peace Convoy were actually located, and busted some heads there, you know, and made 360 arrests of, like, hippies and other New Age gypsies, or whatever you want to call them. And then later, in February 1985, we have an incident at RAF Molesworth. And this was a military police campaign that was organised for 5 months in advance and actually headed by Heseltine. 1,500 troops and police were deployed to secure the 7 mile station perimeter for the MOD. And for the Royal Engineers, who were involved, it was the largest operation since the bridging of the Rhine in 1944. Defence Secretary Heseltine arrived by RAF helicopter wearing a camouflage jacket over his suit. You may remember the images in the media. I mean, the total cost of this operation was in the order of £6.5 million, this is in 1985. All to move 150 people who were in a peace camp, basically New Age Peace Convoy travellers. I mean, these incidents, and also the Battle of the Beanfield, which took place in the summer of 1985, were all part of a wider political and economic agenda for the restructuring of capitalism in the 1980s. I mean, even like some Tory peer, the Earl of Cardigan, who saw the attacks on these New Age travellers, was horrified. And he, obviously made statements to the police about it and everything. And he was called a class traitor by the Daily Telegraph for going on the side of, New Age travellers. Anyway, I got that information it's an unfinished article for the Social Standard, which I've actually been writing since 2012, but I'll try and get it finished before the end of this year, you know, because this year is the 30th anniversary of the Battle of Beanfield. Anyway, moving away from the Peace Convoy and all that, let me just talk a bit about... like some acts of parliament that were actually brought in the 80s, and these are really significant. This is what we're living with today. I mean, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, 1984, perfect year for it to come out. I mean, it gave considerable extra powers to the police. I mean, police powers to search an individual or premises were extended, including the powers to gain entry to premises. And in this act was actually... I think the key factors actually leading to this act were the 1981 Brixton riots and the subsequent Scarman report. Now, the 2005 Serious Organised Crime and Police Act is actually an update of the 1984 Police and Criminal Evidence Act. And again, police powers are significantly extended and powers of arrest are simplified. I mean, the Public Order Act of 1986, I mean, this is just draconian, I mean, and which is what we're living in now. I mean, people have forgotten. Well, it was like before these Acts of Parliament actually went in, you know, it was actually much more easy to, like, stage a demo, hold a public meeting outside on the street. I mean, the Socialist Party could not really conduct an outdoor meeting now. It would be against the law under these sort of acts. You'd actually inform the Metropolitan Police or whatever chief constable to say you intend to hold a public meeting on the corner of, say, I'm talking about Battersea, on the corner of Falcon Road and Battersea Park Road. But then, like, in the old days, the SPGB would just go to the corner of that road and hold a public meeting and everything would be fine. So the 1986 Public Order Act, I mean, this act abolished common law offences of riot, rout, unlawful assembly and affray, and create criminal offences relating to public order. But the key things for freedom of assembly are, like, advance notice of public processions requiring at least 6 written days' notice given to the police before they held the procession. And it had to include details of the intended time and route, give the name and address of at least one person proposing to organise it, and again creates offences for the organisers of the procession if they do not give sufficient notice, or if the procession diverges from the notified time or route. A later sort of public order act is the 1994 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act. Now, this substantially changed the right to silence of an accused person, allowing for inferences to be drawn from that silence. And it gave the police greater rights to take and return intimate body samples, and increased police powers of unsupervised stop and search, a collective trespass and nuisance on land, and included sections against raves, which included the sort of important notorious repetitive beats definition, and there was further sections against destructive trespass, squatters and unauthorised campers, More significantly, it criminalised previously civil offences. Now, this affected many forms of protest, including hunt sabotage and anti-road protests. I mean, John Savage, who's written a lot of books on youth culture and music, I mean, he said about this sort of legislation, well, it's about politicians making laws on the basis of judging people's lifestyles, and that's no way to make laws. I mean, the Act was described as a piece of legislation which was explicitly aimed at suppressing the activities of certain strands of alternative culture, the main targets being squatting, direct action, football fan culture, hunt sabotage, and the Free Party. I spoke about trade unions earlier, and well, you know, they've got significant protections within like the state capitalist era of the state. But I mean, the first sort of major attacks on trade unions come in the early 1970s when the Heath government brought in the 1971 Industrial Relations Act. And this act is crazy because it made all strike action actually became unprotected. I mean, and this is a position which even from the point of view at that time of the bourgeois liberal class was untenable. I mean, the Act was actually opposed by a union mass action in afterwards, and it was repealed by the Labour government in 1974, which restored the protection afforded by the 1906 Act. But it's in the 1980s and 90s, which the capitalist class, with the Thatcher government doing the work, they did it a bit differently. Instead of just like creating one act, they did it piecemeal throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s, basically attacking trade unions and different acts, so sort of narrow picketing immunity, reducing secondary action immunity, secret ballots imposed for union elections and strikes, offences, well, even the Public Order Act, which I mentioned earlier, creating offences related to picketing and increased police power over groups of over 20 people. Other acts of Parliament restricted time off for union duties and removing the closed shops, secondary action protection, and things like that. But it was all consolidated in the 1992 Act under the Major government. Now, this legislation is a gift for the capitalist class, and it's a minefield for trade unions in order to conduct lawful industrial action. And it's bewildering, complex balloting and notification procedures. I mean, the law allows the capitalist class to sue trade unions for damages if they can show that industrial action is unlawful. The capitalist class are also entitled to sack workers involved in unlawful or unofficial action. And trade unions are placed in a position of having to re-ballot, by which time the momentum of dispute can dissipate. And again, you will be aware that this new government that's been elected a couple of months ago plans to even reduce trade union powers that exist already even further by introducing minimum 50% turnout thresholds for strike ballots, insisting at least 40% of workers vote for strikes. I think they're also going to actually make picketing a criminal activity, and employers will be allowed to hire agency staff, which at the moment is illegal, to actually replace striking workers. Yeah, just quickly on the bureaucracy, and then we'll get to like the working class and the capitalist state and the police. Yeah, so we're making the case against like state capitalism or socialism. Neoliberal capitalist ideologues, you know, they excoriate the top-down bureaucracy, which supposedly led to institutional sclerosis and inefficiency in command economies of state capitalism. So with this triumph, so-called triumph of neoliberalism, bureaucracy was supposed to have been made obsolete. You know, it's a relic of state capitalism. Now, but as we all know, this is at odds with the experience of most people living and working in capitalism in the 21st century. Bureaucracy remains very much part of everyday life. I mean, it's changed its form in some ways, but it has, in fact, proliferated. I mean, we've got new kinds of bureaucracy like aims and objectives, outcomes, mission statements. I mean, targets have proliferated, alongside additional layers of management and bureaucracy. You know, workers their performance are assessed, and forms of labour which are really resistant to quantification in our post-Fordist capitalist world. So neoliberal societies are new control societies. I mean, this is where I think of Kafka. He's the prophet today of control societies. I mean, anybody who's ever had to ring a call centre and have to like sort our problem, I mean, it's like a Kafka-esque labyrinth. You know, one feels like Joseph K, you know, trying to like sort out some problem on the phone. I find it really difficult. I've tried to avoid ringing anybody like British Gas or you know, Thames Water or anything like that, because it's just a nightmare. But that's my personal Joseph K feeling. Yeah, so security, not liberty. I like this quote from Bakunin, which I was going to say earlier, but I pulled it out. And he says something like, "It will be argued about the state, the representation of the public will or of the interests common to all, curtailed a part of everyone's liberty in order to assure the remainder of this liberty. But this remainder is security. It is by no means liberty, for liberty is indivisible. A part of it cannot be curtailed without destroying it as a whole. I mean, what we've got now is the fear of Islamic fundamentalism has led to an increase in the power of the capitalist state. I mean, authoritarian measures are everywhere in place, are implemented within political structures that remain notionally democratic. I mean, the war on terror has like prepared us for this development. And we've got a normalisation of crisis, and it produces a situation in which the repealing of measures brought in to deal with an emergency actually becomes unimaginable. I mean, after the shootings at Charlie Hebdo in Paris in January 2015, I mean, obviously lots of different things happening in different countries around Europe. I just want to focus on Belgium, because I just think it's quite interesting, because after that incident, the Belgian state started deploying hundreds of army troops to patrol the streets after the security forces supposedly smashed a suspected Islamist terrorist cell planning to kill police officers. You know, and up to 300 soldiers were deployed in Brussels and the northern city of Anvers, and soldiers were also sent to the industrial eastern city of Verviers. But I just thought it was interesting, because this just came to us a few weeks after, in Belgium, there'd been a massive general strike when 120,000 workers actually marched in Brussels, and it actually led to dock workers actually clashed with police officers who responded by using water cannon. And so Islamic fundamentalism, the fear of it, we've got troops on the street. A few days before, we've got like people on the street protesting about economic inequality. Next thing you know, there's army on the streets. So they say that they're curtailing liberty in the interests of security. But it's interesting, because the Metropolitan Police has a unit called the Domestic Extremism Unit, and it's part of the Counter-Terrorism Unit. Now, Domestic Extremism Unit. Now, you think it's obviously going to be like targeting homegrown jihadists, It's in Bradford, it's in Birmingham, it's in London, working in the Muslim community, monitoring that. But no, the Domestic Extremism Unit is monitoring class war. Now, class war, Ian Bone's anarchist organisation, since they started the Poor Doors campaign last October in London, they've been monitored and followed by this unit and the Metropolitan Police. And also, their public profiles have been raised a little bit because of this Poor Doors campaign, and also because of these sort of candidates in the general election. So they were at an anti-gentrification demo in Camden a couple of weeks ago, and then the Domestic Extremism Unit are there, monitoring class war. There are a bunch of like middle-aged women, an elderly man with a walking stick, a transvestite. Seriously, but just their whole presence actually frightens the state. And they're just symbolic. They're anarchist pranksters. And Lisa McKenzie, she's an academic. She works at the LSE, and she's also a class war activist. She's also a candidate for class war in Chingford, standing against Ian Duncan Smith. So when class war were in Chingford a few months ago, the police were actually obviously monitoring them walking through the town centre of Chingford. But the police were actually, this is what I've got from people who were there, the police were actually going up to members of the public and saying, are you offended or are you distressed by these class war banners? I'll just give you some instances. These class war banners are politicians, old fucking wankers. And we have found new homes for the rich, with an image of numerous graves on the banner. Now, these images, class war, they've been using them for years, even since the 1980s. But they now seem to be deemed a threat to public order, and therefore private property and the capitalist class. I was just thinking about, we've got a banner which says no peace between classes. I mean, I know it's not as extreme as what class war is saying, but that's pretty hardcore. We don't want peace between the classes. And well, we obviously stand for abolishing the wage system, abolition of capitalism, and abolition of private property rights. In some ways, these are sort of extreme demands in capitalism. So I'm recently, following in the media, Cameron, I think he spoke in Birmingham, didn't he? He was actually in Birmingham last Monday, talking about counter-terrorism bill and extra powers to limit the spread of extremism. Home Secretary Theresa May, she said ahead of Cameron's speech last Monday that the strategy would include new legislation likely to include powers to take action against individuals or groups who are considered to be espousing extremist views. Now, she denied it would constitute an attack on freedom of speech. We're not talking about curbing free speech, she said. We recognise that free speech is one of our values. But what we are saying is that we have to look at the impact that some people have in terms of the poisonous ideology that they are trying to implant in people's minds. Let's just move. That's what Theresa May, she's just given the... She's doing the John the Baptist bit for Cameron turning up in Birmingham on Monday. So he says, we need to put out of action the key extremist influencers who are careful to operate, now this is where I get this, just inside the law, but who clearly detest British society and everything we stand for. Just inside the law. So what are we going to do? We're going to move the goalposts so then we can prosecute these people. At the moment, it's legal. And in his speech, Cameron, he attacked the National Union of Students for allying itself with an advocacy group called CAGE. Well, this is a bona fide group. I mean, it's based in London, and it's obviously got an Islamic focus, and it highlights and campaigns against state policies developed as part of the war on terror. And it works closely with former detainees held by the US, and it campaigns on behalf of Muslim prisoners, including convicted terrorists. I mean, a few years ago, Cameron talked about, I don't know his first name, it's called Chowdhury. And he's obviously an Islamic sort of fundamentalist. But again, he's operating inside the law. And the British state doesn't like this because we can't prosecute them. And he says, it's about Chowdhury in 2010, he's one of those people who needs to be looked at seriously in terms of the legality of what he's saying. Because he strays, I think, extremely close to the line of encouraging hatred, extremism and violence. And as you know, the present government actually want to replace the 1998 Human Rights Act, which incorporates the European Convention on Human Rights with a British Bill of Rights. I mean, this British Bill of Rights, no details been put out about it yet. From what bits I've managed to glean, it proposes that the rights of any individual would depend on whether they were a British citizen, i.e. full fundamental rights, or you're an EU national, you get fewer rights, or you're a foreigner and you get even less rights. I mean, this is just inconsistent with the whole notion of fundamental human rights. And then we can get rid of, like, anybody who's just straying within the law at the moment, and we can get rid of them. OK, enough on that. I've titled this section, The Working Class and the Capitalist State. I'm going to focus on the police. I mean, the police are the first line of defence for the capitalist state. What I describe is they're the abrasive edge of the state. This is like when we're walking around, when we're in confrontations with them, it's abrasive. Right, all coppers might be workers, but their role is helping to maintain capitalist law and order. Now, police are the enforcers of capitalist law created by the capitalist state. For God's sake, straight away, the existence of private property is why the police exist. So the state is propped up by the police, who are comprised of working class people. Now, the view in the SPGB is that when socialist consciousness is developing, it will permeate all sections of society at roughly the same time. So the police will have socialist consciousness permeating in their ranks at that time. I've got a socialist standard from August 1971. It's actually titled All Coppers Are Workers. And I'm going to keep going back to this, but I'm just going to give you some quotes from it first. In this article that we state, the nature of their job as part of the state machine ensures that the ruling class will try to ensure that the police cannot strike. Yep, okay. It also says that the argument is often advanced that in the event of a socialist majority attempting to establish socialism democratically, the police will be used along with the armed forces to suppress that majority. And we say, this is an argument which assumes that policemen have political and moral ideas which are very different from those of society in general. The article also says, talking about like police and contacts with demonstrators and industrial disputes, this is talking about the 1920s and 30s, it says, politically ignorant workers, fearful for their jobs in hard times, were more inclined to perform despicable acts and obey savage orders. Police brutality during the 20s and 30s can be largely attributed to this. I will come back to some of these things. It also says police violence during the post-war strikes, i.e. post-1945, has been little. They quote a book by a gentleman called Michael Banton, and the book is called Policemen in the Community, where he points out that the policeman obtains public cooperation and enjoys public esteem because he enforces standards accepted by the community. In other words, if the police are pigs, then they are only a reflection of a society of pigs. They simply do its bidding. The quote goes on to say, the policeman lives in the community and desires to be part of it and have its respect. He needs as a social being, the moral support of the community in doing his job, and will often disregard the law if it is in conflict with what the community thinks is right. The police themselves know the situation. The Federation's newsletter stated that without the confidence, approval and support of the public, the police machine as we know it today would become incapable of fulfilling its function. The history of the police force shows that clearly. And the article goes on to say, our case is that policemen have much the same attitudes as other workers, since they are conditioned by the same economical, social and historical forces operating in society. Socialist ideas were just as prevalent in the minds of any policemen who may still be around. They will be for the revolution, not against it. Now, there's no mention in the 1971 article about that the police exist because of the existence of private property. And also, I think it's out of date, that article. It was written in 1971, and that's a long time ago. Before this whole era that I've been talking about, and I think it definitely needs updating. And I will come back to it as I carry on talking in this section. I mean, there was an article in 2012 in the Social Standard, and this is a bit more updated. And this is February 2012, the North Korean leader on the front. And this is more updated, and it obviously states the existence of private property is why the police will exist. And it states things like the police are workers, just as much as part of the 99% as bank workers, dustmen, nurses, bricklayers, miners, etc. And the conclusion is a bit more hard-hitting as well, and actually... And also the article sort of catalogues some of the police crimes against the working class. But the conclusion is our class has been lied to, tricked, beaten, tortured and murdered by the ruling class through the agency of the state. Again, I still think it needs updating because from some of the research I've done, which I'm going to come to now, quickly about the police and how they're formed. Obviously, because of the existence of private property, the police needed to be set up. But the police were already involved in like suppressing the working class. There were actually 400 special constables who actually brought in to suppress the demonstration at Peterloo in 1819, where 15 people were killed and 700 people were injured. So the police set up at the end of the 1820s into the 1830s. But again, they're not accepted by the people at large. All classes, really, apart from that, the minority property owners, actually need the police. I mean, I've got a section here because I will read it in detail. I'm sorry I'm going on for so long. I didn't realise it would take this long.
Five minutes, Steve.
Eh?
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Well, well, after I finish then, well, there's more than 5 minutes left. But I mean, what do people think?
Keep going.
It's not this far.
Mm. Exactly.
Don't have to rush back.
No, there's no rush. Okay, let me talk about 1833, some incidents which I'd never heard about before. The public cheered when a police officer was killed after police violently attacked a meeting organised by the National Union of the Working Classes. Even the judge described it as justifiable homicide, and medals were actually anonymously sent to the jury. Now, a correspondent for the Times, this is 1833, wrote, "The police furiously attacked the multitude with their staves, felling every person indiscriminately before them. Even the females did not escape the blows from their batons. Men and boys were lying in every direction, weltering in their blood and calling for mercy." Now, two officers, a sergeant and a PC, were stabbed, trying to wrest a flag from one of the demonstrators. Now, no one saw what happened to this Robert Cully, but he staggered into a local pub with blood pouring from a wound in his chest, and he died a few months later. Now, the coroner's jury that examined the death of Cully returned a verdict of justifiable homicide. The jury justified its verdict on the grounds that the crowd had not been ordered to disperse under the terms of the Riot Act, and that the conduct of the police was ferocious, brutal, and unprovoked by the people. A few days after the jury returned its verdict, a package arrived at the home of the jury foreman, Samuel Stockton. An anonymous donor had actually struck a number of pewter type 1¾-inch medallions for Stockton with instructions for him to pass them on to his fellow jurors. Now, the story, it doesn't end here, because the man charged with stabbing Brooks and with the other guys, he was actually acquitted by an Old Bailey jury. And in July 1833, crowds actually thronged the streets at Blackfriars to cheer the coroner's jurors who had returned the verdict of justifiable homicide. And that trip was arranged by a number of city men with radical persuasion, doing on as the Milton Street Committee, for the jurors and their families to sail the Thames up to Twickenham on a steamer. Crowds flocked to the banks of the Thames to cheer on the jurors as they went upstream. This is amazing. This is 1833, by the way. So they sailed to moor at Twickenham, and cannon fire saluted their arrival. The significance of the jurors' verdict was remembered long after, by the way. I mean, a banquet was thrown to honour the anniversary of the jurors' finding, an event hosted by Sir Samuel St. Swithin Burden Worley, the MP for Marylebone. In following a toast to the people, the only source of legitimate power, the Milton Street Committee presented the jurors with a silver cup. And the inscription reads, this cup was presented on the such and such a day by the Milton Street Committee, City of London, to Mr. Robert French, one of the 17 jury men who formed the memorable Calthorpe Street inquest as a perpetual memorial of the glorious verdict of justifiable homicide on the body of Robert Cully, a policeman who was slain while brutally attacking the people when peacefully assembled on Calthorpe Street on the 13th of May 1833. And nearly 30 years later, the verdict of the jurors was still cited in a positive fashion. In 1861, a dinner was held in the honour of this Samuel Stockton, the former foreman, for his work on behalf of the benevolent institution for the poor of St. Pancras. Over 40 local ratepayers attended this dinner at the Argyle Tavern, where Stockton was presented with a French drawing room clock worth 20 guineas. And during the speech, citing Stockton's valuable contribution to community affairs, his role as a foreman of the jury at the Clerkenwell inquest was also mentioned. So just going back to the 1971 article in the Social Standard, a lot of research in sociology research was done in the 1970s and 1980s, which is obviously after this article was written. And this talks about the police and after it had been set up and what it was actually doing in working class communities. And that's what I'm just going to focus on now, briefly. So prisons started from about 1828, the police is about 1830, same sort of period of time. And most of the rest made by the police were just for petty offences. I mean, this is the 1830s, 85% of arrests were for vagrancy, prostitution, drunkenness, disorderly behaviour and common assault. Only 15% for indictable offences, most of them being petty larceny and pickpocketing. I mean, the police were not successful in detecting or deterring burglaries or robberies. I mean, in 1842, the Chartist working class activity was at its height, and the modern police work vis-à-vis the working class political movement begins at this time, because the task of the police was to gain control of working class communities. And here the police established that civil unrest actually comes within their jurisdiction. And then the nicknames like Peel's Bloody Gang and Crushers originate from this time. Now, prior to 1840, virtually all methods aimed at enforcing discipline of the working class were punitive and suppressive. But then the newly confident bourgeoisie, you know, they were triumphant after the repeal of the Corn Laws in 1846. They sent the police to rural working class areas to make the working class accept the habits necessary to be a wage slave for capital. And the police come directly to bear on institutions of daily life in working class neighbourhoods. So a battle actually ensues between the police and local customs and popular culture. So we've got a monitoring and controlling of the streets, pubs, racecourses, wakes, popular fetes, street betting, sports, playing football in the streets. The function of the police is to mould the working class to the discipline of work and leisure, to control leisure. Because once the workers leave the factory gate, they need to be controlled because they're outside the factory gate. They can't be controlled by management there. So the bourgeoisie, wanting a strong police securely lodged in working class neighbourhoods, it can preserve private property, the money of the wealthy, the trade of the merchants and the factories of the manufacturers. So you've got working class neighbourhoods, its recreational space, are under surveillance. Most disturbing is the imposition of we've heard of this, the move-on system, which is a standard item of police policy. Move along now, please. Move on. You know, I think streets in London would have been far, far different, wouldn't they? You know, people just hanging around all the time. Now you hang around, you know, you moved on. Now, I've got all that information from a few sociologists in the 70s and 80s. I will cut it down now, but, I mean, we know about the police and strikes in the pre-1914 era, 1926. Over 100 baton charges against mass demonstrations in the early 1930s, protesting against inequality during the Depression. And I really got to cut it down because I've been talking too long now, but obviously the miners' strike, the use of surveillance, MI5, aggressive policing, Orgreave. So I've taken too long now, so there's a lot of things I wanted to talk about. The police is a political police force. You know, we've heard about the special demonstration squad of the Metropolitan Police, monitoring political groups, spying on trade unions, infiltrating environmental groups between the late 60s and into the 2000s. Maybe probably in discussion, then I could come out with some things. Well, I like that section called Any New Perspectives, but probably I'll have to come back to them in discussion. because I've spoken for too long, I'm really going to have to like close it up now. But we're probably in discussion. We can sort of iron out some conclusions. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Thanks very much, Steve.